This is Julio Rodriguez, and this is the Lookout Landing podcast.
Love won't get you high as this. Drugs won't get you high as this. Fame won't get you high as this. Chains won't get you high as this. Juice won't get you high as this. Crew won't get you high as this. Hate won't get you high as this. Levitate.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Lookout Landing podcast. Thank you, as always, for tuning in. My name is Matthew Robertson, host of this show. You can find me on Twitter at mroberson22. And today I have a very special guest who I'm really excited to talk to. It is the author of Baseball's Leading Lady, a biography of Effa Manley, set to be released in January 2021. The one and only Andrea Williams is here. Andrea, what's going on?
I don't think I've ever been the one and only, so I'm excited about that. But no, I'm good. I'm excited to be here, excited to talk to you and talk about Effa.
Yeah, it's a little interviewer trick. The one and only makes every guest feel very special.
I'm feeling really good right now. I'm not going to lie. I feel great about it.
Wonderful. So I guess before we get into your book and sort of our larger conversation, I feel obligated to ask everyone this year, just like, how are you doing? Like, what's the vibe in your life? How are you hanging in amid a pandemic?
Yeah, pretty well, honestly. I mean, I'm a writer, so I spend a lot of time at home anyway. Probably not writing as much as I should in most cases. My agent would definitely attest to that. But I am definitely kind of used to being at home and hunkering down. I have four kids who we were homeschooling anyway. My husband is a musician and producer, and we have a studio at our home, so he's used to being here. So, I mean, obviously, it is hard to watch, you know, what is happening, and, you know, the virus itself is certainly, you know, I've got kids, and, like, they get scared, and you want them to be aware of what's happening in the world, but you don't want them to be so fearful. And so all of those things kind of, you know, trying to mitigate or temper all of that all the time is definitely a heavy emotional lift. But honestly, I'm doing pretty well. Honestly, I feel that it's been a good year in terms of being able to focus on some projects. If for those who follow me on Twitter, I talk a lot about country music and some of the issues that come up in this Effa book about white supremacy and exclusion and those kinds of things are still happening in country music right now. And so I've been, you know, talking about that. So basically picked up another beat, if you will. And so that it's been kind of cool to get in on those conversations and just really seeing nationally what is happening around, you know, social justice and people asking questions and talking about things in a way that I don't think I've really seen in my generation, this kind of earnest, yes, let's do something, let's start. And I think it's, you know, there's always this question of like, well, when will we know that we've made it? And I don't really know the answer to that. But I think a lot of us, you know, a lot of Black folk are like, okay, how long is this moment gonna last? Like, is this like a 15-minute thing or like a 3 or 4 hour thing? So, but it's definitely been good to see across industry, you know, people, like I said, having those conversations and really being willing to consider disrupting the status quo, because the status quo is racist. So
absolutely. Yeah. And how much of the book did you write during the pandemic? Like, were you done by the time that like things really started to get bad? Or like, what did you have to like hunker down and finish the last part of it as the world was crumbling? Like, what was the timeline like in relation to finishing the book and the pandemic happening?
Yeah, I was done. Like, initially, this book was supposed to be slated for, it was going to come out in September of 20, and lots of COVID stuff, it impacted the book publishing industry like it did so many others. And so I got pushed to January 21. But yeah, it was in the bed by then for sure. Like I want to say in like January, February, we just finished up everything with like photos and captions and all that stuff. Endnotes, bibliography was like the very last thing. And all of that was done by the time we really got into this thing. But I did have a whole other manuscript that I wrote and just finished edits on at the beginning of this week that I can't even really talk about because publishing is so weird and they make you keep all the secrets. So I believe that book will be announced early in 21, like January or February, something like that. But yeah, that was definitely, it was definitely, I had to travel before I started writing the book, and I traveled at the end of February. And so it was like a couple weeks after I got back, it was like everything just shut down. So yes, I did have the experience of writing a book during the pandemic, which was wild. But again, it, you know, I'm a writer. I don't think there's ever a comfortable time to write. So it is what it is.
I hear that. Yeah. I remember last time I talked to an author, it was Emily Nemens, who wrote a book called The Cactus League. And yes. I was talking to her about are you going to associate the release of this book with the pandemic forever? And she was like, oh my God, like, I guess probably, like, hadn't even really thought of it. But I feel like for me, I mean, like, my memories of this year don't include publishing a book, but like, so many of them have been contextualized in such a weird way, mm-hmm. that I think it's going to be kind of impossible to like divorce them from the memory of like, oh yeah, that was when I couldn't do literally anything else. Like, that, right. I did that because I was out of options.
Right, right. And I think it's important. You know, I have friends who have had like hit major career milestones. So I think there's that too. It's that I think it has forced us to look for that silver lining, to look at the bright side, so that you're not kind of wallowing in despair constantly. And I think for a lot of people, there are legit great things to be happy about. And there's that, you know, well, do you talk about the things that you're excited about in 2020? Because it's 2020. But yeah, I think for me, again, so that I'm not, you know, being a writer is such an emotional thing, the creative process. And so for me, like, I can't afford to like trash a whole year and like get really down about stuff. So it's absolutely okay. What are the great things about this year that I can take and remember going forward, even though, yeah, it was kind of crappy. It was a weird time. You know, I wonder though, like, what for younger people, like for my kids, like, I wonder how they're gonna think about this. Cause it is, I can't imagine going through this at like 11. That's a lot. So.
Oh my God. I know. Yeah. I feel for the kids most of all. Like, I'm mostly fine, you know, like I can like keep myself alive and, you know, in decent spirit. But for children, yeah, where, like you mentioned at the very beginning, how there's also like that, you don't want to make them so afraid of life, you know, but also like tell them like, hey, this is important. Like, we got to find a middle ground between like living and also being safe and making sure that they understand the magnitude of all this, which seems impossible. So I guess I feel for the parents and the kids.
Thank you. I appreciate measure. That.
Okay. So let's get into a little bit of background first. Obviously you just finished a book on F.M. Manley, a baseball legend. So I want to know, like, when did you take an interest in baseball? Like, where are you from? Who's your team, if you have one? Like, what happened in your life that made you so interested in baseball?
Yeah, I grew up in Kansas City, Missouri, and was a Royals fan. But I mean, it was hard to be a Royals fan in the 90s. Let's just be honest. Like, we were post George Brett. We were pre like that kind of Johnny Damon, Jermaine Dye resurgence. And so honestly, the team was the Mariners. Like, I was so excited when I got this interview request, because I mean, like, Ken Griffey Jr., Randy Johnson, Joey Cora, Jay Buhner. I was so excited when Alex Rodriguez got there, and then he took the money and ran to Texas. But, oh my gosh, and it was so hard being in Kansas City. Like, we had TBS, so there were lots of Braves games. We had WGN, so there were lots of Cubs games. And I was like, oh my, every week it was like, oh, please let the Mariners be on Sunday Night Baseball this week so I can watch. So I didn't get to see a ton of Mariners games, but they were like by far my favorite team.
So did you, like, growing up then, did you ever consider baseball to be like a thing that you could be a part of? Like, obviously as a woman, there's like barriers that also F.M. Manley had to deal with. But like, for you, were you ever playing baseball, or were you like just kind of watching, thinking like, oh, one day it would be cool to somehow get involved in a certain type of way?
Yeah, I did. I played softball. But pretty quickly, I mean, high school, I knew that I was more interested about the business side of things, more interested in the business side of things, I should say. And so I decided to study sport management, went to Georgia Southern University, studied sport management. And the goal at the time was to become the first female general manager of a Major League Baseball team. And I really, really wanted to work for a small market team like the Royals, like where I grew up. I was really adamant, you know, like, whatever, you know, however I got into the industry, you know, if it was on the marketing side or something like that, I was like, no, I am not marketing the New York Yankees. Like, they don't need the help. Like, I just have these audacious goals about this being this, like, benevolent creature in the world of pro sports, which is kind of like, it's interesting. But then I got a job right out of undergrad at the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum. And that was where I was first introduced to Effa Story and what she was doing in the Negro Leagues in the 1930s and 40s, running with her husband Abe, the Newark Eagles, but then also playing a really big role in the Negro National League, which her team was a part of. And so it was like, okay, maybe this wasn't. Now, by that point, I think I had kind of, I don't really know if I want to work in pro baseball. But she definitely, what she was doing and how she approached her work, that it's not just sports, that this is a platform to, benefit the Black community, to give Black people jobs and security and all those things. I was like, okay, I can get with this. Like, it definitely spoke to, who I was and who I am as a person, that this, the work that we're doing is not just work, that we are to really be good citizens.
Sure. Yeah. And so you just wrote a whole book on her, obviously. So you have, all of the details, probably so many things that didn't even make the book. But I'm curious, because I'm sure you've also had to do this in real life recently. Like, how would you explain who Effa Manley is to someone who's never heard of her? Like, if someone asked you, like, oh, who is that? What was she famous for? What did she do? What have you been saying?
Yeah. So I always lead with the fact that she is the only woman inducted into the National Baseball Hall of Fame. I think that there is still such a lack of knowledge about the Negro Leagues and their significance. So even saying that, oh, well, she owned a team, like she ran a team as a woman in the 1930s and 40s, I think people on the surface understand that significance, but because they don't really know the Negro Leagues, it's not like they don't view it in the same way, that if I said, okay, well, she owned and ran the Brooklyn Dodgers. Like, I don't think in that pure, like, team executive context, people would associate, even if they knew her story, would place her in the same category as a Branch Rickey, which is unfortunate. So then, I have to lead with, like, the women's empowerment thing. And yeah, she's the only woman inducted into Cooperstown. So it's kind of like, whoa, okay. So this is for real. So yeah, I'm glad you asked that, because I am super tactical in how I do that to make sure that people really get how important a figure she was.
Right. And the Hall of Fame thing is so, like, I go down such a weird thought process when I am, like, confronted by that idea that she's the only woman in there, because you're like, wow, like, that's, first of all, like, that's amazing. Good for her. All that, yeah. Like, she deserves it. And then you're like, well, surely there has to be another woman who's, like, worthy of it. And then you think, like, well, there haven't been that many women who have even had the chance. It's that's, not like there's women who are, like, snubbed, the way players are, where, like, oh, you just fell short. It's like there's not really a whole lot of women who even would have, like, a case at all, because there's been so much just barriers for them.
Exactly. And I think that speaks to the importance of, what the importance of the Negro Leagues, like what they did, what that meant, and what we lost when we lost the Negro Leagues. Because 100%, if the Negro Leagues hadn't existed, even if Effa would have still been passionate about baseball and wanted to work in baseball, to your point, she would not have been able to build a career that would even qualify her, that would even have the voters remotely considering her career and her ability to be inducted. So yeah, it was what they built, Effa and the other owners, these really savvy, vision-minded business people, was critically important, because it didn't just provide baseball to fans or allow Black players to get on a baseball diamond when white teams and white leagues wouldn't let them. It really created this ecosystem that also provided jobs for Black coaches. It provided opportunities for Black executives like Effa. The bus drivers, the secretaries, the publicist, like, these were Black people that got to work in a space that, if not for the Negro Leagues as an organization, as an entity, would not have been able to.
Yeah, and you think about, too, like, now there's a heightened conversation around women in baseball after Kim Ang was hired by the Marlins to be their GM. But then you also, I don't want to like rain on that parade, but you think like, okay, that's great. And then you look at the state of black people in baseball. I think it's still one manager, Dusty Baker, who got hired like in a crisis, basically. Like, you know, Dusty obviously has the credentials, but then you think about like the way he was hired and it's like, would they have picked him if they weren't dealing with like a PR disaster and like, you know, players on the decline, executives, I think pretty much non-existent. Right. So you like, it's just very fascinating to realize like, what progress is relative to like certain groups of people and how like, even if Effa Manley was doing all this 80 years ago, there's still a lot of things that need to be done today. Like the progress is never over, essentially.
Right. Right. And Effa, again, like I can't emphasize this enough. Effa was able to do what she did because of the existence of the Negro Leagues. So again, when you talk about and when you get into the book, this is something that my editor and I like were really intentional about, is weaving these narratives together. So it's not just a straight Effa Manley biography. There's lots of Effa in there. It's also a history of black baseball, its rise, its fall. We pick up with players, you know, in the late 1800s, you know, the Moses Fleetwood Walkers and the Bud Fowlers. And we fast forward and we get to Rube Foster creating this first, you know, successful league in 1920, the Negro National League that was founded in Kansas City, Missouri. And then we fast forward to this kind of resurgence post-Depression, where we see the second Negro National League created mostly with East Coast teams. And then the Negro American League comes in a few years later of Midwestern teams. But it is important. That context is important because what I think we miss when we talk about Jackie Robinson and what happened in 1947 and his relationship with Branch Rickey, what we miss is the history of this institution of black baseball and what it created within the black community. And again, what we lost when it was killed, and it was absolutely killed. Branch Rickey going in, stealing players, not paying them, you know, the leagues on the whole refusing to consider, you know, black baseball. How can we integrate these leagues? Maybe they can become official minor league partners. So they develop the black players. We just ultimately bring them up to the majors and sign them when they're ready to go. When none of that happens, you lose the opportunity to have black coaches and black executives, unless there's some really, really, you know, fantastic paradigm shift that, considering American history in general, rarely happens, right? So we have cut off the pipeline that existed. So you mentioned that, you know, why is Effa the only woman in the National Baseball Hall of Fame? Well, how many women have been able to build the careers? So if we're talking about how many black men are head coaches, or black people in general are head coaches in Major League Baseball, or how many are at these high executive level positions, how many are able to even get in the pipeline to work to that point? And we had that opportunity. That the Negro Leagues was the training ground for that. They were training players. They were also training coaches. They were training executives. So when you kill the Negro Leagues, when you say we only want these hand-selected players, we only want Jackie, we only want Campy, we only want Don Newcomb, now you're also saying, well, here's who we don't want. We don't want your black coaches. We don't want your black executives. And so you fast forward, you know, 75 years, and you can't have this conversation today about the lack of black people in all levels of baseball without going back to that. The way we've always done integration in this country has always been to the benefit of the white institution. We cherry pick a couple of deserving black people who will play nice in these hostile situations, and then we let the black institutions they came from fall to ruin. And we also, because of that, again, kill, demolish these pipelines, these safe spaces for black people to develop into the leaders that they would then need to be in these white institutions. And so it's so easy for white people to say, well, of course I'm not gonna hire. Like, where's the talent pool? Like, again, to go back to like the conversations that are happening in country music right now, where's the talent pool? I mean, I would love to hire, you know, a VP at my label, but I don't even know who's ready for that position. Well, they're not wrong, because they cut off the pipeline. So Yeah, it just, you know, again, it's such a testament to the importance of the Negro Leagues. It's a testament to the importance of Effa's work, because she tried to avoid this. She tried to avoid all of this. If she was here in 2020, she would 100% say, I told you this was going to happen and I tried to stop it.
Yeah, it is, like, I would encourage people to think a little more critically about Branch Rickey and like how all of that went down, because he obviously, I mean, he got the Harrison Ford treatment, like he's the one, yes, that people know,
you know. Right? like if Harrison Ford plays you, you're a good guy, like that is right. Yes.
Well, and I think it's so easy for the media and for consumers of that media to think, oh, he was the first person to sign a black player in the major leagues, he must have been great. And like, sure, that is great, don't get me wrong, like it's important that Jackie Robinson played in the big leagues, but like you said, you have to consider, you know, all of the domino effects from that. It was kind of the original, like, well, you got to hear both sides, because you're not getting the full story when you just see that picture of him smiling, signing Jackie Robinson. He's probably thinking in his head, like, oh, there goes the Negro Leagues. I've killed it.
Exactly. Exactly. And if we, I mean, if this was a conversation that we were having in 1950 or 1960, there would have been enough of those voices around and enough of those people who really saw what was happening in real time to say, okay, wait a minute, there's two sides to this thing. Like, let's back up a little bit and let's talk about it. But when you come as far as we have, we're in 2020 now, you know, a lot of those original players are gone. What we're left with is other people's interpretation of the events. And we know that he who controls the pen controls history. So we have been told what to think about Branch Rickey. And so now, not only do you have to think critically, you kind of also have to say, you have to walk into these situations saying, well, what if everything I've been taught was a lie? And I think we've seen that, again, in these larger, you know, conversations that we're having this year around social justice in general. I think, you know, when we talk about, you know, the New York Times bestsellers list, like, let's do this blackout, let's get people to read these books on anti-racism and white supremacy and all those kinds of things. And for a lot of people, it has been that lifting of the veil that, like, okay, what if all of this was a lie? So when we talk about baseball, I think a lot of people who don't know this story, and that is a lot of people, have to be willing to do that. What if everything was a lie?
Yeah.
I think now I got to go back to the beginning, and now I got to start all over, and now I got to really, 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 because you can't think critically. It's hard to look at 2020 and what it looks like now and even say, like, let's have a critical thinking moment. Like, when people talk, oh, well, you know, maybe we need to go into the inner cities and, like, do some baseball programs in the inner cities. If you are not going backwards, if you don't understand the past, you can't understand the today or the tomorrow.
Right. And I think, too, it becomes very easy then. Like, once people realize, like, oh, I need to do something, then it's really easy for it to become, like, a very, like, Mickey Mouse kind of Disney moment where you do one thing and you make it, yeah, all like, oh my God, look at all this great work we've done, you know, without really thinking about, like, are you doing it performatively? Are you doing it just because you feel like you have to? Like, there needs to be a whole other conversation about, like, the motives and making sure that you're doing it for the right reasons, which is kind of back to that whole Branch Rickey thing all over again.
Right. And then you get an understanding really quickly about people who are serious about doing the work versus, you know, doing these performative actions, because when you understand the magnitude of the work, like, it's like if you want to lose 50 pounds and you're like, okay, I'm gonna go see a nutritionist and I want somebody to tell me how to lose 50 pounds in 2 months, they're gonna be like, it's ridiculous, how long did it take you to gain those 50 pounds? That level of, what, you know, the effort that it took to gain that is the same effort that you're gonna have to put in to lose the weight. You gained it, you know, over 2 or 3 years slowly by just making all these tiny decisions daily. That's how you're gonna have to lose it too. So if we're talking about undoing these systems, we have to have the same intentionality that was there when they put the systems in place. This wasn't an accidental performative thing. You don't cut black people out on accident. This is, like, embedded in these systems, like, level by level, decision after decision. It plays out over multiple years. That's what it's going to take to undo this stuff. It's not a book you read. It's not a nonprofit program that you start, you know, in inner city Chicago and throw a couple black kids on a baseball field. Like, this is real work. And so when you start talking about that, you can quickly divide the people who are serious and the people who are not.
absolutely. I'm glad you said that. So with Effa specifically, was she someone you'd been wanting to write about for a while? And then, like, you know, like you mentioned, the increased conversations about race relations in this country come up kind of right as the book is on its way to publishing. So was that a coincidence? Because you mentioned that the book had been pretty done by the time that the pandemic and then the protests this summer started popping off. So, like, did you think that was just kind of like kismet? Or like, what was, when you like realized that you were writing a book about Effa Manley at a time when America was focused on race more than they have been in a while, like, what are your thoughts as that's all unfolding in front of you?
Yeah, I mean, I'm Black, so I feel like these issues are always there. But I would definitely say that, like, my publisher is excited about it for sure. You know, this idea that we can, you know, definitely sell more books now that people are having these conversations, you know, within publishing, within the kidlit space. There is a push for, you know, not just books about, you know, that highlight untold stories or, you know, figures who wouldn't normally get a full, you know, biographical treatment, but also that they come from the communities represented in the pages. So that had been happening for a while. If I'm to be completely honest, like, I feel like Effa's been sitting on my shoulder for like, I left the museum in like 2007. So what, like 13 years? She's been sitting on my shoulder that whole time. Like, when are you going to write the book? Like, when are you going to write the book? So I am late to this party, but I guess I got here right on time.
Yeah, no, it doesn't matter when you get in, as long as you're in there. And I feel like too, like, with your specific situation, it's like you have, working for the Negro Leagues Museum gives you such an interesting perspective and probably a little more of a foundational knowledge base than other people. So, like, with that in mind, you don't want to, like, rush it. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, it's not like, oh my God, I'm done at the museum, let me get this book off right now, you know?
Yeah, like, I don't even think, I mean, I was just, you know, shortly after I left the museum, started, you know, freelancing as a journalist. But, like, I mean, writing a book is such a daunting thing. And I think, I mean, I had to get through years of just like, I don't know if I can do it. Then, you know, I'd kind of segued into ghostwriting. So basically helping other people tell their story. So then it was a whole other mountain to get over in this, you know, with this idea that, like, I can write my own book. So there's been lots of hurdles throughout this process. You know, not necessarily because of like ability or talent, but just, you know, the imposter syndrome that we all deal with at some point, I think. But yeah, it is definitely an exciting moment. Even being pushed to January is kind of cool. My editor is like, look, we'll be right in front of Black History Month in February. We'll be right in front of Women's History Month in March. And then hopefully we'll get a new baseball season, you know, starting on time in April. And then this June represents the 15th anniversary. June of 21 is the 15th anniversary of her induction. And along with, I want to say it was 26 people total in that class. I was actually at the museum in 2006 when the Hall of Fame put together this special committee to really dig back in and see, okay, who else have we missed? You know, again, it's white on all levels of this thing, right? It takes Ted Williams getting up during his Hall of Fame speech and saying, look, Satchel Paige should be here. Like, this is ridiculous. So, but even then, you know, when you start saying, okay, well, I know Satch, I know Josh, like, these people get in, but we're already so far removed from, again, you know, Moses Fleetwood Walker and Bud Fowler and those guys that were playing in the late 1800s, those guys that were playing in the years before Rube Foster started the Negro National League. I mean, Rube Foster, many people don't know, was a great pitcher, a great athlete himself. He just went on to found the Negro National League and became more known as an executive. But there were lots of players that had missed that window. So, and to the larger point, to Effa, players, coaches and executives. So in 2006, there was this push, there was this special induction with over 20 Black players, coaches and executives from the era of segregated baseball. And Effa was included in that class. And so we get to celebrate her again in 2021. So timeline wise, you know, it all works together.
Yeah. And so you mentioned something that I wanted to ask you about, which is, like, you know, the Negro League legends that the casual fan knows, like Satchel Paige, Josh Gibson, Cool Papa Bell, all those people. They are obviously much more known than Effa Manley, even if Effa has sort of the aura around her from being the only woman in the Hall of Fame. So what do you think it will take for America to like bring that same energy for her as they do her male counterparts? Is it just more knowledge, like, you know, more books, people educating themselves, people like seeking it out? Or do you think that there's like a larger problem that needs to be addressed, or both, I guess?
Yeah, I think it's both. I think definitely, you know, people should seek the knowledge, but it's a difficult thing because, again, you kind of have to suspend like your normal way of thinking a little bit, because you have to ensure that you're getting your your information from the right sources, from people who, you know, are giving this history a fair treatment, that are not telling it through their white lens. But ultimately, it's going to come with, you know, baseball, with Major League Baseball, with these larger entities being honest about our history. When we, you know, there was a segment on Real Sports on HBO with this being the centennial of that founding of the first Negro National League by Rube Foster. There was a Real Sports segment featuring Larry Lester, and he's done such great work documenting and like going through these newspaper archives and pulling together these stats and showing that the Negro League players really operated on a level comparable to what Major League Baseball was doing. And that's important because in Major League Baseball's eyes, the Negro Leagues, when they are acknowledged as kind of like this other thing, like this kind of second class, like B-level minor league thing. And so when you do that, it ensures that people who played before the era of integration don't get in the history books at all. And so when you don't have these people, you know, in the history books, in the stat records, well, then, yeah, why would we talk about FMLE? We don't even really acknowledge the Negro Leagues as these, you know, real professional operations. So there's, again, the intentionality in exclusion has to be there when we talk about inclusion, when we talk about recognizing and honoring these people who came before and did such incredible work during such a difficult time.
Yeah, so I guess then my next question would be like EFA specific, and how much you knew about her heading into this process, and then some interesting things that you learned that you hadn't known before. Like, what was, I guess first question is, how much do you feel like you knew about EFA when you started writing this book? And then how much did that sort of like transform into, oh my God, there's so much to even, that like I was completely unaware of?
Yeah, I knew quite a bit just because I was really obsessed with her when I was at the museum. So I knew quite a bit. We had a copy of her memoir that she wrote, couple years before she died, and I'd read that, so I knew, you know, pretty well like how involved she'd been in running her team, helping to run the Negro National League, even though she never officially had a title because her husband Abe had the title. So I knew that. I don't think I knew how much she pushed back against not integration, just integration, not in theory, but in practice, in the way Branch Rickey did it. So she was, again, she really understood what the Black community, what Black baseball was up against if things continued on the path that Branch Rickey laid forth. So it was really interesting to get in and to see these conversations, this back and forth. And she had a back and forth with you know, Jackie Robinson. She said some things about Jackie Robinson in the media, because in 1948, you know, he comes out and completely trashes Black baseball in Ebony magazine. And she's like, wait a minute, you ungrateful child. Like, what are you doing? Like, it is because of Black baseball that you are playing now with the Brooklyn Dodgers. Like, it is only because of that. So she definitely was outspoken in a way. Like, I think, you know, there's always this conversation about like who would be great on Twitter if they, you know, had been alive when Twitter was a thing. I think she'd be incredible. I think even if she wasn't tweeting, she'd be trending so much just because of the things that she said and the way that she really operated without a filter. Like, she just said what she thought and was really such a straight shooter. I think that that would be incredible. I think we'd be talking about that today. But the fact that she was that person in the 30s and 40s is just tremendous. So I kind of understood that, but like really digging in and seeing her in action, recreating that through newspaper articles and archives and things like that, was, you know, her letters. All of that was like really, really fun to see.
And it's so, like, this is all completely related to what you were saying earlier, but, like, how history is only coming from one specific outlet, or, like, you only hear the stuff you want to hear. Like, Major League Baseball tries so hard, and they succeed at the most part for, like, making Jackie Robinson seem completely bulletproof. Like, nothing, he didn't do anything wrong. Like, he is this savior. Like, you know, he came in and changed everything, which he did. Like, you know, Jackie Robinson is very important, but you would never hear about the fact that he trashed black baseball. Like, that's something that Major League Baseball would never, ever, 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 ever want to get out. And then you have someone like Effa who's like calling him out for it, and that's amazing. But like you were saying, you never hear about it because it only gets, you know, only one side of it gets reported.
Right. You don't hear that Jackie Robinson trashed black baseball. You also don't hear that by it didn't even take to the end of his life, but you know, his second memoir, I Never Had It Made, that was published the year that he died. I mean, he's had a complete transformation, and we rarely give historical figures that opportunity. The Jackie Robinson that we celebrate, the 42 that everybody, every team has retired and everybody wears on Jackie Robinson Day, that is the Jackie Robinson that said, yes, I will turn the other cheek. Yes, I will let these people call me the N-word and I will say nothing. That is who they're celebrating. That black player who was deemed worthy enough to come in and accept abuse en route to some, you know, progress, and I'm using air quotes that you can't see, because again, how does that really help us? We know how it helps the Dodgers. We know that they set attendance records that year. We know that they made more money. We know that, you know, he set them up to start winning pennants. We know that white baseball, these white institutions absolutely benefited from, you know, bringing the few black players in that they did at the slow rate that they did. But how did it benefit us? We've always been taught that integration is this inherently good thing and it's good for everybody. But the way we've done it in this country has rarely, if ever, benefited black people. And we don't talk about that because that's not the Jackie Robinson they want us to know.
Right. Yeah. It's so indicative of like Major League Baseball's thinking as a whole, the way they like selectively choose to ignore certain things. Cause like you said, the 42, like everyone wearing the jersey is like, yes, we celebrate the man who, you know, basically chose to like kind of, I don't know, like subvert some of his own morals, I would imagine, and just be like, yeah, I'll let these people just attack me because I'm doing this great thing for America and for baseball. I mean, like, in Major League Baseball today is kind of doing that same thing where they're like, look, we have Jackie Robinson Day. We're not racist, you know, like that whole thing of like, if we do one thing, that means that we're scot-free on every other issue.
Right. Exactly.
This is completely unrelated, but I was just Googling as you were talking. Are you like a collector at all? Do you have any Newark Eagles merch or like a hat or a t-shirt or anything?
I mean, I have a couple of things that like I've purchased. Like I had some stuff. I don't think we had any like Newark Eagles specific stuff when I was at the museum. But yeah, I'm not a collector though, by any stretch of the imagination.
Gotcha. I was just curious because I'm looking at their logo and some of their jerseys, and like it's such an interesting aesthetic because it's so of a time, you know. All of it kind of looks like old like cigarette logos and that kind of thing, where it's like if you covered up the word Newark on the Eagles logo, it could totally be like Eagle cigarettes or like Eagle whiskey or something like that.
Right.
This is not like completely unrelated to anything we've been talking about. I was just curious.
No, I'm not mad at it. And I also wouldn't be mad like if we brought the throwback jersey back. Like I am, you know, I would not be mad at that at all, for sure.
Yeah, I guess it's tough for a team like Newark because there's no like immediate affiliation or connection. Like Kansas City, I feel like the Royals do at least one Negro League throwback every year. But for Newark, they're kind of just left out in the cold.
Yeah.
Cool. All right, so we're going to get to a passage from the book at the end of this episode. But I have a couple more questions before we get to that. One of them is just kind of like a writer question, like little inside baseball kind of thing about the writing process. I just want to know, you mentioned how daunting it is to write a book and how much research goes into it and making sure you hit all of your marks and all that. So what was the hardest or most challenging thing about this entire process? Let our readers know like what it's really like to sit down and say, I'm going to write a whole freaking book.
Oh gosh, it's horrible. Like I, and this is like, and I always have like multiple projects going on at one time, but like writing, I mean, there are moments when it's great, when it's fun. And then you're like 2 seconds later, it's like, oh gosh, this sucks again. But overall, the feeling of having the finished book is so great. It's like, you know, I remember like before I had kids, like asking my mom, like, well, how much does it hurt when you have a baby? And she's like, yeah, well, God makes sure that nobody really remembers or can really describe it. Otherwise, nobody would have kids. So I think it's like that, like in the moment, you're always, I mean, at least I am. I don't want to speak for any other writers, but every time, like, and I'm in that messy middle, or I'm like, I'm so far in that I can't turn back, but I'm still so far from the other side. I'm like, why do I do this to myself over and over again? Like willingly, like I sign up for this. But then, you know, in the end, it is always so worth it. But I would say, honestly, for this book, the most difficult part was weaving together those two narratives that I mentioned before, Effa's story with the history of Black baseball with its rise and fall. This book is really, I envisioned it for kids. I have four kids. My oldest is 13. She reads voraciously, but doesn't really like nonfiction. We also talk a lot about, you know, these gaps in curriculum. And, you know, again, we're in this moment right now where people are having these conversations about, you know, America and how we've treated each other here. And I think to a large degree, a lot of what we are dealing with is people who, like, you know, to your point about, well, why don't people know who Effa Manley is? I think we're dealing with adults. Our world is being shaped by adults who don't, and this is me like glass half fulling the situation and saying, all right, yes, some of y'all are just evil and malicious, but also I think there's a good number of people who just don't really know. They don't really understand our history, the way these things were set up. They didn't get the talks like Black people get the talks. Like we know, like we can spot a white person a mile away. Like we know who's really for us and who's not. Like white people just go through this world, like because it is designed for white people, not really understanding all that is happening below the surface, all this intentionality and excluding certain people and building walls and all of that kind of stuff. And so when you have these people who don't understand and then they're creating, you know, our policies or that are in leadership positions in, you know, baseball front offices or whatever, we end up having to spend so much time just educating, just getting the history, just trying to get people to see us, to value us, to understand our perspective. So I'm like, well, what if we just talk to these kids early? You know, what if we help them understand early? I mean, I remember being in school and reading books, reading history textbooks about how, like, well, maybe slavery wasn't so bad. Like some slave owners were really nice. Like there's a lot to undo within the education system. And I am not an educator, but if I can create a book that is a compelling read that also starts to bridge some of these gaps, that also, again, helps people understand the world of yesterday so that they can better understand today and hopefully build us a better tomorrow, then, I mean, for me, that is the ultimate end goal. So I didn't want to just write an Effa Manley biography. I didn't want to just, you know, place the reader in these exciting moments where, you know, Effa's pushing back against Branch Rickey or Jackie Robinson and, you know, fighting on behalf of her Black team and her Black league that she was a part of. I wanted to really set the stage so that by the time we get to that moment, this is not just some kind of throwaway thing that, oh, well, Black baseball won't be able to operate after Jackie because, you know, in the end, it's great because shouldn't Black players want to play Major League Baseball? I have set the stage so people understand how important these institutions are, what it took to get these institutions off the ground, the constant sacrifices that were made so that they can really see the full consequence of integration done Branch Rickey's way. So it was difficult, again, because this is a book for, on paper, 10 to 14 year olds, even though I think, you know, there may be some kids younger than that who can get into it. I have an 8-year-old who is a sports junkie and I'm like, I need a report on this, like the week it comes out. But also, you know, I think it'll work well for adults. I think a lot of times when we're talking about history and going back and really understanding where we've come from, I think sports is a great microcosm for racism in this country, and I think it's a great way to study it. I think when we talk about the Negro League specifically, it reveals so much, but I also understand that adults who are busy with jobs and kids and COVID and all the things might not have time to read this, like, 500-page book on the Negro League. So this is like a really, like, bite-sized, like, really good introductory primer into Black baseball, but then there's also a lot of Effa just because she was such an important character. So yeah, how do you make all that work, you know, in one book? How do you keep kids engaged? My goodness, like, again, like, I've got kids, and like, yeah, my daughter's like, what? This is a true story? You're kidding. So, like, making sure that it's a good read that also does all these other things in a not, you know, textbooky, preachy way. And that was another thing, too. Like, I think we say so much how, you know, we're so excited about future generations. And, you know, these kids are the future, and they're so smart, and they're so, you know, they're so gifted. Well, if we really trust them like that, I don't think, at least, again, I'll speak for me, I don't like to tell my kids what to think. I like to present all the information and see what they do with it. And again, I think, and this could be me, you know, maybe my glasses are a little rose colored right now, but I think that if people had all of the information at their disposal, there will be more people, not everybody, but there will be more people who would make better decisions. So, even as I'm talking about all this and I have very clear thoughts and opinions, I don't need to say that Branch Rickey was a jerk and not the savior that people say he is. I'm going to lay it all out. This is the show, not tell, right? I'm just going to lay it all out, and then you decide. And then what do you do with that information now? What do you do with that information? So yeah, it was a balancing act for sure.
Totally. I feel like you and every writer, especially people who are sort of telling the story that people haven't heard before, you're trying to address that impossible question of, like, how do people know what they don't know, right? There's right. So much information out there that, like, is just completely, it's not taught, or it's completely, like, out of their, you know, field of knowledge that you're, so, like, for Effa Manley specifically, you're introducing her, I'm sure, to a lot of people who have never heard the name, but then for people who are, like, only sort of tangentially aware, it's like, okay, what did you not know that I can then try to teach you without trying to make it preachy or, like, you know, here's what you need to think about Effa when you're done with this. Like, I'm right. I think the intriguing part of writing a book about someone is presenting information in a way that doesn't seem like you are sort of in their pocket, you know, like, yeah. Obviously Effa Manley didn't pay you to write this book, but, like, it can, there's people who write biographies that do come off that way, where it's like, oh, did the family tell you what to write? Right, you know, that right, whole right, sort right. of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, you know, it's that, you know, how much context do people already have? Do kids already have? How much context do I need to provide? And so it's like, if I'm introducing Effa as this owner of the Newark Eagles, well, the Newark Eagles aren't around. So I got to explain what the Newark Eagles are. And then I'm like, okay, well, it was a team in the Negro National League. Well, that's not around anymore either. So then I have to explain what that was. And then when I start to explain what that was, it's like, well, I don't understand. Like, I know Major League Baseball, but, like, what is this other thing? So there's, like, there's a ton of setup. There's a ton of backstory that has to be done that doesn't have to be done, you know, in a Branch Rickey book, for instance, because I don't have to spend time explaining what Major League Baseball was for you to understand, you know, who Branch Rickey was, because we have so much current day context. We don't have any of that with the Negro Leagues. And yeah, I had to find a way it was important for me. I mean, I guess I didn't have to, but with the ultimate goal for this book, I thought it was important to weave that in.
Yeah, and for kids especially, where they're so impressionable and they're being taught the things that the school district and the textbooks want them to learn. Like, I remember exactly. Being a kid, as soon as the term necessary evil was brought up in relation to slavery, I was like, wait a minute. You know, like, that's when you start to question things. And it's important to have other sources that aren't just, you know, the standard issued textbook or the things that your teacher is getting paid to say. Like, that's why it's so important to seek out information, which obviously, you know, as, you know, a writer and a parent, like, there's so many things that I think the rest of society has to fill in the cracks when it comes to learning. And if you're not actually trying to do that, then you are never going to even have the opportunity to do it. So like a book like this is perfect for people who think like, oh, you know, I feel like I have a decent understanding of the Negro Leagues or just race relations as a whole. Then it's like, well, maybe you didn't know any of this, and this is going to introduce a whole new perspective to you. Like, that's so important, not only right now, but forever. Like, it's so important to get as much information as possible, especially about things that maybe are relevant to you in a way that you're trying to ignore, the way that race relations are for so many white people.
Right, right. Yeah. Yeah, and this book, I mean, it is 100% told from the black perspective. It is the black experience. It is all sides of it, right? Black people are not a monolith. We weren't a monolith in 1947. So there were 100%, I mean, again, with Jackie Robinson coming out and saying these things in Ebony magazine, it reveals the pretty and the ugly of all of that. And it's not, you know, Branch Rickey's there. I mean, you can't talk about integration without Branch Rickey, but he is not a central character. You know, Jackie Robinson in I Never Had It Made, he said that, you know, essentially, and this is a paraphrase, that integration, the way it was done, it was the Branch Rickey show. And he was just brought in as a performer, as, you know, to play his part in it. But it was never his story. I mean, we try to spin it that way. But most of the time when we do it, and these white people that still tell it through the white lens, we don't even get the full story. So you're trying to tell Branch Rickey's story through Jackie Robinson's eyes, and it just doesn't work like that. So this is a story that is 100% from that black experience.
Beautiful. Well, we covered everything and I wanted to ask you, so we might as well just get to the passage. People have probably been listening to this thinking like, oh, I want to read this book. I want to hear this information that she keeps talking about. So we can actually go ahead and do that right now. You've prepared a passage from the book that you want to read. I'll just lay out and let you sort of audiobook it. And hopefully people will be inspired to actually purchase the book after this. So whenever you're ready, you can go ahead and just start reading the passage that you've selected.
Okay. All right. Clear my throat. No. As integration landed on baseball's doorstep ahead of the 1946 season, gathering a consensus on the right way to merge the worlds of white and black baseball was proving impossible. Like Griffith, Ethel believed that the Negro League's contract should be respected and that owners of black teams should be compensated for their players. She also believed that the Negro League should be formally integrated into Major League Baseball as an official minor league partner. But none of the white baseball executives, including Griffith, were advocating for that. As it stood, the lens of integration became focused on opportunities for individual black players, not for entire black teams or leagues. And within the broader black community, seeing those players join the rosters of white teams in Major League Baseball was the ultimate best goal. For many in the black community, the Negro Leagues had passed the point of usefulness. All black teams and leagues were previously necessary, but no longer ideal, not when the majors had finally eased open the door that had been bolted shut for so long. Whether black players should actually walk through that door was never questioned, neither did anyone consider what lay on the other side. The fact that the door opened at all was the unquestionable proof of progress. Nowhere was this more evident than in Jackie Robinson's journey from Negro Leagues rookie to Major League barrier breaker. The signing of his Dodgers contract was an historic moment, certainly, but it was also one that was fraught with tension, a sign of torturous things to come. Years after joining the Dodgers organization, Robinson recounted his first meeting with his future employer, detailing how Rickey lashed him with degrading insults and described in horrific detail the abuse that Robinson was likely to face on the baseball field. Suppose I was at shortstop. Another player comes down from first, stealing, flying in with spikes high and cuts me on the leg. As I feel the blood running down my leg, the white player laughs in my face. "How do you like that, nigger boy?" he sneers. Could I turn the other cheek? I didn't know how I would do it, yet I knew that I must. Rickey used this exercise to make his expectations clear. Robinson was to be a model player and man, someone who could simply absorb all the criticisms and indignities that were sure to be hurled at him. Not only was Robinson forbidden from retaliating, but he would also have to smile when he wanted to cry and apologize when he'd done nothing wrong. Through it all, Robinson was to remain grateful for his marvelous blessing while ignoring its accompanying curses. And he had to be perfect. Man, did he have to be perfect. There could be no missteps or wavering, as Robinson's signing would be the country's first experiment with integration that had national implications. This was not a light-skinned, middle-class black woman in New York being hired alongside white women in a department store that had a predominantly black customer base. This was a man with deep brown skin joining a team with white men who, in most cases, had never even had a conversation with a black person, let alone a relationship. Yet they would be thrust together to train and play and live. And they would have to travel to cities that were far less open to racial equality, where fans would be just as likely to show up to root against Robinson as they would be to cheer for their home team. Indeed, as the 1940s gave way to the 50s and 60s, racial integration in America typically followed a similar pattern regardless of industry. After proving themselves sufficiently worthy, a few black people were hand-selected, ripped away from the safety and security of their communities, and allowed to enter all white spaces. Once there, they ran straight into people who resented their presence and often retaliated with violence. Yet there was never any sacrifice required of white people, no demand that they too step outside of their comfort zones in the name of advancement. Even as their glass houses were shattered by the arrival of those whom they'd fought valiantly to keep out, whites still maintained the upper hand. Black people were sent crawling in through the back door, careful not to make a fuss. They were there to be seen and not heard, lest they be booted right back into the street. This was the standard to which Robinson had to adhere. It was what Branch Rickey demanded of him, but it was also what all of white America would require as well. Jackie Robinson was expected to turn the other cheek on the baseball diamond, and black baseball executives were expected to do the same behind the closed doors of their team offices. But as integration threatened to bankrupt their businesses, EFA and some of the other owners refused to remain silent. In early November of 1945, EFA helped Cum Posey, owner of the Homestead Grays and secretary of the Negro National League, write a letter to Major League Baseball's new commissioner, Happy Chandler. Though EFA never held an official title within the Negro National League, Posey and the other man recognized her value and often relied on her expertise, and she was eager to lend a hand to this matter in particular. The tiff between EFA and Posey of years prior had long been brushed aside. The only thing that mattered in that moment was the preservation of black baseball. Writing on behalf of both the Negro National League and Negro American Leagues, Posey condemned the way Rickey had gone after Robinson and was continuing to poach black players. Aside from his refusal to compensate Negro Leagues teams for the contracts of their players, Rickey was bypassing team executives to speak directly with the players about joining his team, a policy that was unheard of in both black and white baseball. We feel that the clubs of organized Negro League baseball who have gone to so much expense to develop players and establish teams and leagues should be approached and deals made between clubs involved, even though Negro organized baseball is not a part of white organized baseball, Posey wrote. That is the only way in which we can be assured that Negro organized baseball can continue to operate. To close the letter, Posey invited Chandler to a Negro National League meeting that was scheduled for November 9, 1945 in New York City. And with that, Ethel Posey and the other owners could only wait and hope. They hoped that Chandler would accept the invitation to the league meeting, and most important, they hoped that he would sympathize with the owners of black baseball teams. Meanwhile, as they awaited the commissioner's response, a letter of support from Washington Senators owner Clark Griffith imbued them with faith. Your two leagues have established a splendid reputation and now have the support and respect of the colored people all over the country, as well as the decent white people. They have not pirated against organized baseball, nor have they stolen anything from them, and organized baseball has no moral right to take anything away from them without their consent. I understand that Mr. Rickey told Commissioner Chandler that Robinson was not under contract to the Kansas City Club, but whether he was or wasn't, he certainly made an agreement with the Kansas City Monarchs Club that he would play ball with them for so much per month. This in itself constitutes a contract, for had Kansas City failed to pay him, he could have gone to court and collected his salary. Mr. Posey, anything that is worthwhile is worth fighting for, so you folks should leave not a stone unturned to protect the existence of your two established Negro Leagues. Don't let anybody tear it down. It is my belief that the commissioner will give you relief. That's it.
That was great. Thank you so much. I feel like that really, like, because we talked about all of these things, you know, and Jackie and Effa and how they're all related. And then to hear it sort of in book form is a perfect little bow to put on the end of this episode. So thank you so much for doing that. I hope that encourages people to buy the book. And now as we're wrapping up, I want to give you a chance to not only plug the book, but plug whatever else you want to draw people's attention to. And I guess perhaps most importantly, let people know how they can purchase this book.
Yeah, so I am on Twitter at Andrea Wilwright. That is a platform I'm probably most active on. But the book, Baseball's Leading Lady, Effa Manley and the Rise and Fall of the Negro Leagues, will be available January 5th, wherever books are sold. I'm not sure when this is going to air, but if it is well before then, if you order from Parnassus Books in Nashville. So let me pull up. ParnassusBooks.net/Andrea Williams. That's ParnassusBooks.net/Andrea Williams. You can pre-order it and I will sign and or personalize it for you. And that offer is good up until like January 4th, so the day it publishes. But yes, please order the book. Please buy it for yourself and your kids and your boss and your girlfriend and your boyfriend. Like all the people. All the people need the book. So
all the racists in your life, get for them too.
All the racists, but not even like, I mean, I want black people to read this too. I participated in Turner Sports during the playoffs, did a 4-part documentary piece celebrating the Negro Leagues. And I took part in it and it was a great experience. It was fun to, again, talk about these things that we don't talk about enough. But I made this comment in the last segment that, you know, white America doesn't mind if we want to be the next Satchel Paige or the next Josh Gibson, you know, the next LeBron, the next Steph Curry. But what if we wanted to be the next Effa Manley? What if we wanted to be the next Rube Foster? So I 100% want black kids and adults to read this too, because I am of the firm belief that if we were able to accomplish these things in the 20s, 30s, 40s, what can we accomplish now? So much more.
Yeah, you said it. Well, thank you so much, Andrea. It was a pleasure to have you. I do hope that this boosts your book sales through the roof and you become a world famous author. And also to get Effa Manley the shine she deserves. So thank you for joining us. Everyone who listened, appreciate you as always. Please subscribe to this podcast if you feel so inclined. Like Andrea said, you can follow her on Twitter at Andrea Will Wright. I'm at mroberson22, and please continue to read Lookout Landing as well and follow all of our work on the site and on Twitter. Any final thoughts, Andrea, before we let you go?
No, I thank you so much for inviting me on. It's been super fun. I will not be mad if you want to send me some Mariners tickets in appreciation. I mean, you know.
If I had the power to do that, I would. But we do not get that many perks, unfortunately, as a lowly blog.
Yeah, I hear you. But no, it's been great. It's been really fun. And I appreciate you taking the time to talk to me about Effa and the Negro Leagues.
Of course. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, everyone who listened. And until next time, goodbye.